Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hi.
Hey, you guys.
How are ya?
Happy Tuesday or whatever day you're listening on.
Yeah, happy recording day for us, at least.
I know, we're thrilled to be here.
Love it. We had a little hot girl walk.
We did.
We had smoothies because it's nice out.
Yeah, we had smoothies. We went for a walk. We talked our shit.
Yeah. Gregory talked his shit. If you know, you know.
It's true. Poor thing.
Yeah,
it's He's our third host.
He is. He is still got a knife.
Yeah.
And he is my ulcer, if you didn't know, because now I feel like that he's made a threat. I have to tell you that.
Yes, correct. He's like, give me all your money.
Good luck eating anything that you like. I'm not really supposed to have a smoothie, but did I? A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Was it worth it?
Mostly.
Okay. So far?
Mostly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes.
Sure.
It's really good. We're playing this fun game with like what Greggy would get mad about.
Yeah. It's called What Makes Gregory Stab Me Today.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a fun little game.
We're poking the bear.
Significantly better than it was last week. I'll give it that.
Yeah, I mean, you're not in the ER right now, which is really cool.
Living it, loving it, picking it up. Also, whatever meds they gave me, doing the trick.
Yeah.
So helpful for that. Thank you.
We love to hear that.
But other than that, we haven't been up to a lot.
We did do a bestie day.
We did. It was cute.
Do you want to tell them about our bestie day?
Sure. You'll talk enough in the next few. So we went to the beach, which was really cute.
So windy.
We're going to read, but it was so windy. We kept getting sand in our mouths when we were talking. Mm. And that was not fun. But the beach was pretty. And it was such a nice, like, cloudy day at the beach.
It was.
I love a cloudy beach day.
It was beautiful.
So we were there. It was one of the first nice days out. So obviously, like, everyone is at the beach, which ain't that just the New England way?
Yes.
So that part was pretty fun. We did a little drive. We got some dins. I had salmon.
You did?
With just butter and vegetables. But I could eat it. So, hey.
I had, love like, it. Probably one of my top 10 best wedge salads.
Ooh.
I dig that.
Love that.
I'm a big fan.
I really like that you like a wedge salad because I couldn't be bothered. I don't want to have to cut it. If I'm getting a salad somewhere, I want you to cut it for me.
I'm down. I'm like, put me in, coach. I'm ready.
Yeah, you know? You are. You love a wedge.
I do. And I love a wedge shoe. I always got my heels on.
I always say that about you.
You really do. It's true.
Because you're 3 feet tall.
Correct.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You didn't even fight me.
I'm surrendering to it at this point.
I love it. It's all right. I got clown shoes, so.
It is true. Yeah. You do.
Well, especially if you're 3 feet tall, they look real big.
Yeah, well, you come clonking in here and...
Okay,
you
know, that's just because I'm clumsy.
Fucking up my shit, so.
I've only fucked up the paint job behind your washer.
You sure about that?
Yeah.
I'm sure we will find evidence elsewhere.
Oh, fuck off.
Like coffee stains.
Oh, coffee stains. I don't count that as fucking up shit.
Oh, we're only talking permanent? Okay, yeah, that might
yeah,
be
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Because okay. You can wipe that up with a paper towel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what we got. Well, if you guys didn't know, we have a big appetite, and today is no different.
And we got to get into it because there's a lot of today.
There's a lot. So Abby only knows kind of what we're talking about because I said, listen, I got a multi-parter.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to be honest with you, at this point in my research right now, guys, I'm at 22 pages. I don't know if this is a 2 or 3-parter. I just know that we're going to get through part one today.
Yep.
I'm still working on things and organizing and seeing where she lies. So we're in this for at least 2 to 3, but no more than that.
Yes.
We're not hitting a JonBenet here.
Okay. I don't think anybody should have to hit a JonBenet ever again. That was a lot.
It was a lot, but I do kind of miss it. That was pretty good.
2 months straight of a hyperfixation.
Yeah, but we could do a recap.
That's true. We could.
With some new stuff with them. But anyway, today, you know because you clicked it, we're talking about John List. So without further ado...
Yoo-hoo! Pot's on.
Hi, hello, and welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast, About Time for True Crime.
Oh, it's us.
It is. We love hanging out with you in our little corner of the true crime world, and as you know, there's room at the table for everybody. Some sources I use just to start us off here include, but are not limited to, the New York Times, the U.S. Sun, L.A. Times, lots from the Crime Library, the book called Death Sentence by Joe Sharkey, and I listened to last podcast on the left's coverage of this, as well as an investigative podcast called Father Wants Us Dead, which I do find very interesting because there's a lot of interviews, and with this being kind of dated, a lot of hearing it from the people that were interviewed and sort of that were involved in this case at that time is good because there's not really a lot of records of it otherwise.
Yeah.
And I think last podcast on the left had a two-parter on this case, which I actually often don't agree with their takes, but I really like the research. So I like a podcast that I disagree with too. I feel like I'm still learning something, but I think they're problematic sometimes. But I do think that the research in this case was good. We did have a lot of like overlap with some sources, so
nice. Yeah,
I think it was good.
They do good research. Even if it's a lot to get through sometimes.
I think if you isolate like Marcus of, because I think he does like the bulk of the research, at least in this particular podcast. I think that they all do things on the side too, but his are really like the way that he writes a story. It's very easy to follow along, so I do like listening to him.
Yeah.
But anyway, so let's get into John List.
Yes.
You might know a little bit about this case if you're a hardcore true crime girly like myself. I remember hearing about this case, in like so many different crime shows, but one of my earliest little introductions to it was actually from my dad.
Oh,
he does not know this, but he got me a like crime a day calendar.
Yes.
That I still have and look through. He gets me a different one every year. And there were like 6 or 7 days in a row that were all like part one, part two, part three of John List. Because there were so many different freaking things going on with this guy. And so I just kind of like jotted his name down of like, I need to remember this one and look into it. And then I did. And then we started doing this. And I was like, wait a minute.
Was that the one you got when we first met?
I think I might have had one before it.
I love those. I used to like sneak into your cube and just to read through them.
Yeah, because you gotta.
Yeah.
So we got all that good. So let's jump into it.
Yay.
This case includes a lot.
Okay.
So warnings. I mean, for this entire series, we're talking about murder.
Yeah.
And murder of children.
Yeah.
Murder of the elderly.
Okay.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
But I will say that with most cases, there's a lot of like violence and gore and sort of thing. And with this, we're not getting that.
Okay.
So we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about a bunch of like really gory, bloody, crazy things because the crimes themselves happen in a matter of minutes.
Okay. So it's not super graphic or explicit.
No.
Okay.
But it does include a lot of themes. Like religious influence, inner dialogue, shame, and the buildup of internal and external pressures.
Okay.
So when I was researching this case, this is kind of what I envisioned, and I encourage you to maybe do the same, which was kind of like a pendulum swinging, because I think that his swings so far the other way, but with a lot of the ideas and like a lot of things in our society, if you just split the difference down the middle is where most people are happy.
Yeah.
And then there's like the outliers of like the extremes on either side. So, for example, like fill in the blank with anything, entertainment, right? We used to not allow nudity in movies.
Yeah.
On TV, you wouldn't see that. How horrid. We were like appalled. But now it's like uncomfortable to watch anything with your family because there's so much nudity in it. So like the pendulum have swung, right? We were like, we went from never to nearly always.
Yeah.
In a matter of 80 years.
Yeah.
So this pendulum comes into play when we talk about John's family, both growing up and then how he also went on to lead his own family. where splitting the difference is where many may have fallen, he swung the pendulum all the way to one side.
Got it.
So he really is an extreme version of the things that he is. And I don't think that he's representative of like the group of people that he tends to kind of belong to. I think he is like out there.
Yeah. Well, and that happens with, you know, a lot of people who have a lot of very specific delusions. Like if it's religious or like a celebrity version, like the celebrity isn't consenting to all of these delusions of grandeur. And most people in a religion aren't usually supportive of the same extremes that people go to when they've got this kind of mental health.
Yes. So he, yeah. And it's not that he's got delusions in that he's believing in an alternative reality, but I think that he so badly wanted that reality to be real that he was forcing it on other people around him.
Got it.
And I think then the last few episodes we've been like very religious heavy. That is not at all intentional. It just happened to be the cases that we have found and have been drawn to. But as a Christian, I'm not insulting any like Christian religions here, but in this particular case, a lot of what he ends up doing, he believes, he claims, is rooted in this faith. We're going to talk all about it.
Okay.
It's going to make more sense as we go. Okay?
I'm sure it will.
John Emil Smith was born September 17th, 1925, to German-American parents John Frederick and Alma List. He grew up in a predominantly German community in the Bay City area of Michigan, and he was an only child.
Okay.
The List family were devout Lutherans. His father was a Sunday school teacher and very, very strict, where his mom seemed to sort of compensate for the dad's roughness. Okay. Not that she was super doting and maternal, but she was ever present. And like, if she could have wrapped him in bubble wrap, she would have.
Got him.
It's notable that John's dad was 61 years old when John was born in 1925, and his mother was 38.
Okay.
So there was about 20 years between his parents. John's dad had been married previously. His first wife, Maria, had passed away, I believe, of cancer in 1923. And Alma was his wife's nurse.
Okay.
After his wife passed away, John Frederick, or I'll say John Sr., I guess, and Alma hit it off, and they, I guess, got together, because within the 2 years between his wife's death in 1923 and John's birth in 1925, he married Alma.
Okay.
While many argue today that some only children are raised with parents who are too doting, too enabling, and it ends up turning into a person who is self-important and kind of bratty, which may give way to an entitled adult, John's childhood couldn't look any more different from that.
Yeah.
This does not mean that it was a good childhood, but it does mean that he was not like the apple of their eye. He got everything he wanted. He essentially was forced to blend into the background. There was almost no room for him.
Mm-hmm.
Him being an only child, it's kind of hard to imagine, I think.
Yeah.
But his dad really couldn't have given a shit less about him. In seemingly every way he could, his dad just didn't care. And he instilled his strict Lutheran values, but to say that they had a loving relationship, like, you'd really have to stretch for that reach.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a different time, I suppose. But even for the time, it was strained and cold. He referred to his son, John, as the boy.
Okay. So this is more than like a children should be seen and not heard kind of cultural difference. It's like, he's here.
Yes, and I mean,
the boy is here.
Right, and as was the time, right, the seen and not heard, you're over there, you do this, this is adult things, this is kid things, and you've got shit I'm going to give you to do.
Yeah.
It's a step further than that.
Right.
For example, throughout John's childhood, he didn't even have a bedroom. He had to sleep in the living room.
Oh.
When he woke up, he had to put all of his bedding away. He had to put anything that belonged to him away, like in a drawer or something. Like, everything had its spot.
Got it.
And that was expected to be as soon as he woke up. So basically, as soon as you wake up, erase any evidence of yourself.
Yeah.
Because you had to sleep in the living room. And this room is functional for the day. So pack it up.
Yeah.
And he, I suppose you could say, became very, like, routined in that way and very particular and very obsessive about things having a spot and things going away and just very anal about all of that. And actually, his dad had converted the upstairs of the family home into an apartment for rent. So in the wake of the Great Depression, I can appreciate the desire for a second income by renting out a piece of your house. But it is notable to mention that as a result, young John did not have much in the way of privacy, and the room that probably could have been his would have been upstairs, and instead he had the living room.
Got it.
Religion played a large role in John's childhood and adulthood. You'll see it referenced repeatedly anywhere you go to look it up this case. You're going to see it. It's like synonymous with John List, and many point to it as one of the root causes of what happened later. In fact, his own defense will point to his faith as the driving force for his horrific acts.
Mm.
And I assure you we're going to talk all about it, but I will sort of push back on that narrative a little bit, and I will explain why. But what's important to know about this era of John's life is that his dad led his life with strict adherence to the Lutheran faith.
Yeah.
And deviation from that was not acceptable. Lucky for John, he adhered just fine. His father was of the belief that you worked long hours, you provided for your family, and you dedicated your life to God and the teachings in the Bible. So you went to work, you came home, your life was about the Bible.
Right.
And reading it and memorizing it. There really was not room for much else. And for John, he sort of took to that because it was a routine and he was craving routine.
Yeah.
And he kind of had this sort of obsessive brain that he needed something to latch onto, and this was given to him as forced to do, but he also liked pleasing.
Right.
Because of the emphasis of taking care of your family, it left no room for social services. John's father believed that to accept welfare was a sin because it meant not only admitting that you couldn't provide for your family, but that you depended on someone else to do it. John's pendulum swing, again, that of his family for that matter, was all the way to the other side where, like, it should never be available. You shouldn't accept it even if needed. Nobody should have it.
Got it.
Whereas I think a lot of people might fall with, like, in the middle. There's a need for social services. Not everyone needs them.
Right.
But if there is a need, it should be available. And many people that share this faith are also in this middle. So this is not, like, indicative of this particular religion or this sect of Christianity. This is specific to this family
household.
Family and this very strict, like, German influence, sort of, like, they all spoke German, they all, you know what I mean, like, the community that they grew up in was very unique outside of even other areas of Michigan, so very fascinating in that way. But just to say that When we talk about the pendulum swinging, like, his is in another continent.
Yes.
John's dad was known as kind of an ass. He was vocal about his views. He had little to no tolerance. He wasn't exactly a present father in the way that we might view it today.
Yeah.
John's relationship with other kids actually suffered because of his upbringing. So from what I can piece together, these views were far more strict than the majority, but these views shaped John's life entirely. And I think with all of this sort of, like, adult mature content, and I don't mean sexually, but I mean, like, so much about morality and all of these, like, really big conversations, John was not really able to connect with kids his age.
Well, and I can imagine too, like, if you're a kid looking up to your parents and that's who you're, as a child, idolizing but also sort of mimicking to replicate in yourself, if what he's seeing a man as is what his dad is, that's also not very fun to play with on the playground as someone who won't tolerate your views because theirs are so staunch and so rigid in their own way.
Right. And that they were kind of forced upon other people, like, where you and I just know this because I know you and we are the same in this way, but I'm not yucking anyone's yums. I want you to have your views. I don't care that they're different from me. Just don't tell me how to live my life.
Yeah.
He would be, and this family would be, you should live your life the way I live my life. Here's why you should live your life this way.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
So he had a reputation in the neighborhood, the dad did, of being kind of a dick. And John himself had a reputation of being essentially nobody.
Got it.
And we'll talk about it, because John didn't have friends. He didn't play outside. He didn't get dirty. He didn't run around. In fact, one of the only times John ever got punished as a kid was when he ran in the house.
Oh.
Like, he ran in the house. Not ran in the house and, like, started a fire. I mean, ran in the house.
Poor kid.
And he did that one time.
Yeah, I bet.
He wore a suit to school every day. Always dressed so prim and proper. He was hyper obedient to a fault. Subscribed to all the same ideologies his dad did, and when asked why he didn't play with classmates outside, he said that his mom would be upset if he got his clothing dirty.
Oh.
So no part of his, like, he didn't get to be a kid.
Yeah.
Not in the way that you'd want for your kids. You know what I mean? He didn't run around and play sports or make friends or play hide and seek or do anything. He was kind of an outcast, and not really that he was, like, starving for this. It was like, well, mother would be happy if I didn't anyway.
Right.
So he was kind of okay with it.
Yeah.
Or at least seemingly.
Yeah.
His mother was afraid of him falling ill, and she kept a very tight leash on him. And we're talking about the 20s and 30s. Illness, I understand. This was their only child. She was maybe what you'd call a helicopter mom, just in that how afraid she was of anything, like him getting hurt.
Right.
But it matters. And I think the context of the time also matters. You know, like, infant and child mortality was higher than it is today.
Certainly.
And for lack of a better term, the leash was taut.
Yes. Short.
It was as if he was to believe that life beyond his parents was full of sin, illness, evil, and his best defense was to just stay quiet and stay close. Speaking of his mom, though, while we've covered how his dad was, let's talk about Alma.
Okay.
Alma's present for the long run here.
Oh, okay.
So, hope you love her. She seemed to try to overcompensate for her husband's distaste for John, or if it's not distaste, just his, like, meh feelings toward him. And with that, she was just sort of overbearing and hand-holding. I mean, in a way that the pair were inseparable.
Right.
All the time, a typical child would be running around with his friends. John wasn't doing that. Not because he was sitting alone, but because he was hanging out with his mother.
Right.
It's even said that they both walked and talked the same. Like, her mannerisms and the way that she spoke really rubbed off on him. Yeah. In, like, kind of an unsettling, not endearing way, that he was just like a little mini me of her.
Well, you know how they say you're like a culmination of the five people you spend the most time with? Mm-hmm. That means he's five times more like her than you or I or anyone else is, like, anybody that they mimic.
Yes.
And mimic not even intentionally, like, subconsciously you start to do this. So it's just, it makes sense to me that they, okay, little side tangent for my brain. It won't be super long. I used to watch Gilmore Girls as a kid a lot. And there's one episode where Rory is watching Lorelai and her mom both, like, do something exactly the same. I feel like it was get ready for bed or put on makeup or something. It was mirror involved, but it was exactly the same. And she was just like, oh, weird. Like, just strange to see. I feel like it would be that constantly with them.
It would, because when you're a kid, your parents are your first sort of influence for socializing.
Right.
How they interact with you, how they interact with each other, how they then go and interact outside of the home. That's your first blueprint.
Right.
For socialization and how to behave. And as you grow up and you go to school and you meet kids in the neighborhood, you learn from all different people. But he's only learning from these two people, and dad's always at work and doesn't want to talk to him when he is home.
Right.
So who's he really learning it from?
Yeah. So how much interaction is there really to learn from with dad?
Correct.
Yeah.
So it's all Alma Bear.
Oh, Alma.
problematic, for sure. And maybe it was a little bit better than they were brought up.
Right.
Alma and John Frederick, or John Sr., probably had vastly different, significantly worse childhoods that compared to their sons, night and day.
Right.
But still.
Raising the bar from the sewer to the floor doesn't make the bar not on the floor.
Correct.
Yeah.
And when he's hanging out with his mother, they're talking, they're walking, maybe cooking, doing whatever. But most nights they read the Bible together before bed.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that he would do right up until he killed her.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. This was John's childhood. Overbearing parents in different ways, each damaging him in different ways. Probably, again, both believing they were doing the right thing. Probably still believing it is a hell of a lot better than their childhood, and it probably was. John's childhood encapsulated the saying, children are to be seen, not heard, as he quite literally was rarely seen and even more rarely heard.
Right.
John's only social circle was the one within their church. Here, he attended Sunday school and he attended church, and he attended most functions that were put on there with his family. He had to memorize Bible verses. It was metaphorically, maybe even literally, beaten into him that the slightest infraction would earn him a one-way ticket to hell.
Yeah.
He walked a very narrow line, and because of this fear, he almost never stepped out of line. So while other kids sinned, like kids do, he sort of turned his nose up. Mm. He didn't really feel envy at, like, at least they're able to do that. He kind of had this, like, well,
yeah,
kind of... Air
well,
to
at
him.
Least I'm not going to hell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't know his mannerisms, but I just kind of, like, picture him as very, like, ugh.
Yeah, he wears a little suit to school. You know he's wearing an even, I don't know if even nicer isn't like they had one, but certainly a more prim and proper one to church.
Yeah, like, yeah. He didn't envy what other kids had. He just felt he was above them because he felt like he was doing all the right things and they were doing right and wrong things.
Right.
And to me, this just sounds like a rendition of the Joker's origin story. Personally, I know we're really digging into the religious versus societal versus individual family and their interpretation of religious and societal issues, but this so shapes John and who he became. And it comes up a lot in dissecting how a man could murder his whole family. Because in case you didn't know, he murders his entire family.
Yeah.
The man did not have skills or connections to deal with problems in any way whatsoever. I mean, even in the most basic ways, he didn't have the skills. So these problems or issues or whatever he was battling festered. And then they festered some more.
And then some more and then some more, probably.
Any adversity was met with a locked jaw, stiff neck, and suppression. Like, he buried that shit deep.
Yeah.
But in 1943, John List graduated from Bay City Central High School and enlisted in the U.S. Army.
Okay.
He served as a lab technician during World War II. His father, John Frederick List, died in 1944.
Okay.
This was while John was still active duty. He was granted a very brief leave so that he could attend the services. It's said that he showed no emotion at his father's funeral.
Yeah.
And this emotionless presentation is present in John his whole life. In 1946, John was discharged from the military, but he did go on to utilize his GI Bill, this bill that allows service members and immediate family members to attend higher education at a reduced or no cost. And he actually began his bachelor's degree at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
Okay.
He earned this bachelor's degree in business administration, and then he went on to get a master's in accounting.
Wow.
It's also said that his mother, Alma, would come visit him at school, which mm-hmm. is very sweet, but kind of weird when she'd visit him in his dorm room and sometimes she'd stay the weekend, like just to hang out. Maybe... This was something of the time. This never happened when I was in school.
Same.
I didn't do it. None of my friends did it. Maybe it did happen. I didn't hear of it. And maybe this was more common then. But to me, it strikes me as kind of weird.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my family has visited in school, but it was usually like, I'm not going to stay in this 9x13 room with you,
mm-hmm.
where you usually have a roommate.
Yep.
And it's usually separated by sex.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe John might have made friends or had people over, been hanging out, but instead his mom would just regularly come up and hang out with him.
Right.
And I don't think they were like going to the bars and partying like you might think of it today. We're talking the 40s.
We're talking reading the Bible before bed.
Correct. Probably not at all unlike what they did at the house.
Right.
His mother was also one of the influences that pushed him into accounting. Like, he had to consult her before he moved forward with his career path.
Okay.
And she kind of chose accounting for him because it would be safe and reliable and he could provide for himself. I mean, she was trying to think of something that would best prepare him to provide for his own family.
Right.
But it was that he didn't go by passion. He went by what his mother would think I should do.
Right.
And she sort of decided that for him. John's dad had been in charge of the church's money, I'm assuming like the church treasurer or something, so she encouraged John to follow his lead.
Okay.
An accountant was respectable and safe, just how he needed to be.
Right.
And I don't know about you, but the logistics of having anyone stay over in a dorm room are tough, but I cannot imagine being his roommate. I just think of like if you were his roommate, and it's like, I'm going to have a girl over tonight. You're like, all right, yeah, buddy. And then it's like, it's his mother.
Yeah.
That's just different. Anyway.
No, I'd be sleeping on someone else's floor, personally. I'd be like, it seems like you need the space.
I hope he didn't have a roommate, but I just, like, I picture it in my mind.
Yeah.
That he did, you know?
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah. Yeah.
In 1950, John was recalled to active duty as the Korean War ramped up. He was stationed in Virginia, I believe still serving as a lab tech, and he met a woman named Helen Taylor at a bowling alley.
Okay.
Helen Taylor was a widow and a single mom. Her husband, Marvin Taylor, was killed in action in Korea in April of 51.
Oh, that's awful.
He was only 33 when he died.
Oh my gosh.
So she was on her own, raising her 9-year-old daughter, Brenda, by herself.
9 years old.
9 years old. They had been together several years, and after he died, she was obviously having a hard time, but they met at this bowling alley and seemed to sort of hit it off, and John and Helen married in a matter of months.
Wow.
So if you think that her husband died in April of 1951, John and Helen married December 1st, 1951. Perhaps Helen sought comfort in the aftermath of her husband's death, and she found it with John. But I think more than anything, she thought John was a safe bet.
Probably.
And if this is what she thought, she could not have been more wrong.
Yeah.
But John, though a 2-time war veteran, hadn't seen combat, hadn't left the war with physical or mental scars. He was good at crunching numbers, as he was when he was in school, and he was relatively successful.
Okay.
And that sense of safety that Helen may have felt might have come from the fact that his personality was as bland as porridge.
Yeah, he sounds like he's got the personality of tapioca pudding.
He's like if there was plain unflavored Jell-O. I don't know if that exists, but if it does, that's John List. He's cream of wheat. He's unsalted, unflavored rice cakes. He's stale crackers. He's boring.
He fits my diet.
You could eat John List. Aww. You could with your ulcer. You would be allowed to eat only the things that he is. He works hard. He does not talk much. He will try to provide, I guess, as he's been bred to do. Any issues he has, don't worry. He won't talk about them. He will just bury them deep down until they build up and explode.
Oh, that seems healthy.
You wouldn't know it by looking at him if he was battling anything inside, because he didn't really seem to have much on his mind at all. And I don't mean that he's like aloof. He's just bland. He's just,
well, this is what I do now, and this is what we do now.
Like, you'd leave that and you'd probably feel tired. Like, he reminds me of Colin Robinson in What We Do in the Shadows, which if you haven't watched it, you definitely should, but like an energy vampire who just like takes the energy out of the room. I imagine. I haven't seen him described as like the worst person in the world to talk to, but he doesn't talk much. And when he does, it's just like a flat affect. There's just not a whole lot there.
And if he continued in any of his father's footsteps in the content, I can imagine it'd be like, okay, all right, actually it was okay when we were quiet.
Yeah. And maybe it was these qualities, you know, that he did keep things to himself and he did go to work and keep quiet and provide it. And maybe it was these qualities that drew Helen to John that made her feel safe. Like, okay, I can do this. I don't know what her husband was like. We're going to talk about him in a little bit, briefly.
Okay.
But she could have just felt like, this is safe. I feel safe with him around my 9-year-old daughter.
Yeah, he's seemingly dependable, respectable.
Yeah.
Hardworking. Which are all good qualities. On their own.
They are. And in other people, probably great. But in this man and what happened later, unhealthy.
Yeah.
Alma, John's mom, was suspicious of Helen. And not for the reasons that you'd probably think, like, she'll never be good enough for my son. Worse.
Oh.
She was frustrated with Helen in a way because Helen had reportedly had several miscarriages, which was like, well, you're not going to provide heirs. Like, you're not going to provide grandchildren. You're not going to give my son children.
Oh.
So that frustrated her. And also that she wasn't, like, she didn't belong to their church.
Okay.
Which I don't know if that meant that she just wasn't their religion or she just didn't go to the sect that like they went to, like their particular place. I'm thinking it was the religion.
Yeah.
She just wasn't of their religion. And this made her unsavory. So Alma wanted grandchildren, and if Helen would struggle to conceive, she didn't really fit the bill. And Alma did not try to conceal this from Helen. Helen was very well aware of where she stood with her mother-in-law, and it was not great.
Okay.
They did not get along. Alma was always making jabs at John about how his wife wasn't good enough for him, but, like, not in anything in the way that Helen behaved.
Right.
Only in just, like, who she was and
just her identity and being in her experience. Yeah.
Yes, like, what her body could provide John with.
Yeah.
John was caught in the middle between his mother and his wife, but he never stood up to his mom.
He just needed a Reddit thread to be like, man, not the asshole, or you're the asshole.
I know. While marrying her so soon was out of character for John, who was very calculated and poised, it was even more out of character to learn on my end that before he and Helen married, she'd fallen pregnant.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me that much.
I just figured John, oh so holier than thou, would not partake in a sin such as sex out of wedlock.
Sexual relations with that woman?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think the order of events here was that she told him she was pregnant, so he had to marry her right away for appearances and again, a child out of wedlock was a sin and John couldn't sin. However, once they were married, right? So remember the timeline. Her husband dies in April.
Yeah.
They are married by December.
Yeah.
Don't know where they meet in there. I believe like summer, fall area.
Got it.
And she's knocked up. So that could be why they got married so fast. However, once they were married, John found out Helen wasn't actually pregnant.
Oh.
I don't know what was going on there. Did she know she wasn't? And she told him that? That's what most cases say.
Okay.
Most people believe that she kind of like, quote unquote, tricked him.
Got it. The old bait and switch. But do we know for sure that it wasn't that she was pregnant and miscarried?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
That to me is she could have believed she was for another reason. She could have actually been and miscarried.
Okay.
Or she knew she wasn't and she told him that anyway.
Okay. Because that's important. Those are very different things.
Correct.
Yeah.
But there's also something else John didn't know.
Oh?
And that's that Helen hadn't told him everything.
Well, they didn't have a lot of time to chat.
No, not much, but Helen did have syphilis.
Ew!
She'd contracted syphilis, it's reported, from her first husband.
Okay.
I believe he had been out and about, and he was active military, and potentially overseas at times, and I don't know.
Extramarital curriculars.
Yep.
Yep.
And so many sources go back and forth on whether or not she knew. I think she did.
Mm-hmm.
But she might not have thought it was that bad or that impactful because she wasn't symptomatic.
Got it.
So maybe she thought it was cured. Maybe she thought whatever. But she had contracted syphilis from her first husband. And as a result of this disease, she did have those miscarriages during her first marriage. So a lot of these miscarriages are attributed to having syphilis. There are a few different versions of history on what happened next, though. Some sources say that it's during the 40s and 50s, and antibiotics like penicillin necessary to treat syphilis were largely unavailable because they were sent to soldiers.
Right.
Because that's where the need was. And she wasn't able to access them. And others stated that she had sought treatment, and perhaps it just wasn't cured. She thought she was, and it wasn't.
Okay.
Others are that she didn't seek treatment at all.
And you said she's asymptomatic?
At this point, yes.
At this point, okay.
Whatever the truth was, John found out after they were married.
Mm.
She did, in fact, know she had it at this point.
Oh, okay.
But we are not judging anyone who has or has had a sexually transmitted disease or infection. Rather, we would just like to encourage you all to get tested and ask partners to also be tested.
Yeah, the last time I looked, it's like 1 in 5 sexually active people have some sort of STD or STI. So just talk to your doctor.
Safety first.
Yeah.
Many are easily treated, and syphilis, even back then, was easily treated.
Yep.
But Helen's, for whatever reason, was not.
Okay.
Because she had had syphilis for years, it was actually no longer contagious.
Okay.
John did not contract it from Helen.
Okay.
Nor were their children infected.
Okay, but that also means we're getting into mid and late stage syphilis, which is also not good for the brain.
Oh yeah, we're just about to talk about that too.
Oh yeah.
So as part of my research, I did a little bit of a deep dive on syphilis, on its symptoms, treatments, and its late stages, which we did learn a lot about from Al Capone.
Yay.
What I learned was that usually for the first 2 years someone has it, if it isn't treated with antibiotics, the individual will still have it, but it isn't contagious anymore.
Okay.
So you have this contagious period. Helen had it a lot longer than 2 years when she met John, which is why John never contracted it, and again, which is why the kids never did either when they were born. Initial symptoms include painful sores, and then if not treated, those sores can turn to a rash for a few months.
Yeah.
But this rash can spread across the whole body and can be accompanied by other symptoms, like fever, fatigue, muscle aches, weight loss, headaches, hair loss, swollen lymph nodes, and other sores. These symptoms can come and go for years, though. So even if you present no symptoms, this does not mean that it has gone away. And I think a lot of people dealing with that, when they have a flare-up, they might attribute headaches or hair loss or something else to something else.
Right.
That they're not going to say, oh, it was this thing I had 3 years ago that I just thought cleared up on its own because all evidence of it went away.
Right.
And then it comes back and maybe you have swollen lymph nodes and you have some muscle aches and you think, geez, am I coming down with the flu?
Mm-hmm.
Something to be aware of. But it has not gone away and it does need to be treated. The third stage of syphilis is called the latent stage, where you may not see the effects, but the effects are happening.
Oh, yeah.
Bones, nerves, and organs can be damaged at this time. It's rare but possible to pass the infection to a sexual partner during this stage, but not often. A person might experience mild flare-ups during the stage, but most symptoms have subsided by this time. In the final stage, the disease begins eating away at the brain and other organs in the body, and this happens more rapidly than it had been happening before. Most people don't get to this stage because normally it's treated, but those who do experience irreversible damage.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, the damage is done. You're not coming back from this. And this damage can include brain damage, dementia, cognitive decline, seizures, blindness, nerve damage, heart disease, movement disorders. Untreated syphilis can kill you. Just ask Al Capone.
Yeah. Al boy.
Why are we talking so much about syphilis, you might ask? Because Helen will experience the disease up to the final stage, and it will impact every part of her life, and by extension, every part of John's and their families as well.
Okay.
To set the scene, though, it's the 1950s.
All right.
They are married. John and Helen moved to Detroit, Michigan, where John was working at a very successful accounting firm. In January 1955, Helen gave birth to their first child.
Okay.
A daughter they named Patricia.
All right.
After Patricia, or as her friends called her, Pat or Patty, they had a son they named John Frederick, seemingly after John's father, John Frederick.
It seems.
I'm just making assumptions. And then in 1958, she had their third and final child, Frederick Michael.
Okay.
By now, Helen had stopped attending church functions with John.
Okay.
She didn't subscribe to his religion. And instead of having any kind of dialogue surrounding this, because again, this meant so much to John that she go, John simply buried his frustrations with her about this deep down. Oh. Rarely lashing out, and just proceeded forward.
So also super healthy, good communication, really open, trusting relationship. Okay.
Yeah, excellent communication, great marriage. I mean, on the flip side, they weren't having, you know, knockdown, drag out fights all of the time, but it was because he wouldn't react.
Right.
She would do things that upset him. It wasn't that he was immune to being upset. It was just that he never showed it. Or was willing to talk about it. He did not have the skills the man never learned. And at this point, as an adult and now a dad of three, it is your responsibility to learn how to communicate.
And teach that.
But at this time, with what's going on, with the pressures he's feeling, was all of that available? Did he have the skills to even start? I can't answer that. But I will say that part of this almost seems like Helen is just poking him to see when he will react, because I think there's a frustration in a relationship as well from Helen's part, where it was like, what do I need to do for you to react? Right. Like, what do you care about? What does mean the most to you?
Well, and I think about like kids when they get upset when their parents don't reprimand them. It's like, well, do you even care? Like, you don't even care enough to get upset, much less be happy.
Right.
So I could understand that.
And Helen was going through a lot, and we'll talk about a lot of it. She became very depressed.
Okay.
My guess is in part due to postpartum depression, which certainly would not have been talked about nearly enough at that time, but she had three children back to back to back.
Yeah.
And I didn't see that specified, but I do think that that's a piece of it, but also mental health.
Yeah.
Helen began drinking more often, and that ended up leaving a lot of the child rearing to John. And John was working full time and his job was well paying, but with that came responsibility and pressure because Helen wasn't working.
Right.
She was the homemaker and she was the stay at home mom, but she left a lot of those parenting pieces to John, who was now balancing trying to be almost like a 100% full time parent while being 100% full time provider.
Right.
While also taking care of his wife, who was drinking and kind of unable to take care of herself at this point.
He's got a lot going on.
When he got home from work, he cared for his young kids, his wife, who's now battling blindness.
Oh, okay.
And struggling with alcohol use. She also began using medication. I believe these were like tranquilizers.
Okay.
Kinds of medications, which can be deadly when coupled with alcohol. John's frustration grew even more. Sometimes he would tremble with rage.
Oh.
But he didn't say anything. And when he did, it seemed that Helen either chose not to listen or wasn't able to in her state. It happened so rarely, and when he did say things, it wasn't this big lash out.
Mm-hmm.
And she would just kind of write it off, or she was severely intoxicated and on pills at the same time, which was neither of them were in any situation to have a, you know, healthy conversation.
Yeah. Or one that she'd remember, probably.
the family moved around a bit, and he landed a job in Rochester, New York, so they moved. And then he landed another job, and then another job, so they did move a bit.
Okay.
He ended up landing a job in New Jersey at the First National Bank of Jersey City as vice president.
Wow. And they moved, a big job.
They moved to Westfield, New Jersey in 1965.
Another Westfield?
Another Westfield.
Oh my gosh.
I'm telling you, it's everywhere.
It's a glitch in the matrix.
It seems like it. John asked his mother, Alma, for money for the down payment on a 19-bedroom mansion.
Huh?
He was doing very well as the vice president at a bank. However, he couldn't afford this home on his own, and his mother, Alma, did agree, but on one condition, that she live with them.
Well, that should be easy. They got 19 fucking bedrooms.
While John's new position paid very well, Helen had been spending more than they could afford. I don't know if she knew she was spending beyond their means, or if John just kept his head down and kept trying to make it all work and didn't let her know that the amount coming in was not enough to cover the amount going out.
Yeah.
And that they might want to scale back on their spending. Regardless of that conversation happened, the spending didn't stop.
Yeah.
Now, John likes to point to Helen being the one that spends a lot of money, but as we'll talk about in a later part, it takes two to tango, and I do think that he could spend as much as he could earn. I don't think he left all of that to her, but they were not doing well financially, despite what you'd think they would be, considering his job and this beautiful home they just moved into. I mean, of course they must be doing well. But John, Helen, their three kids, and his mom Alma moved into the mansion. This is the last place that five of the six of them would ever call home.
Okay.
It was Helen that insisted they purchase the mansion, according to John. This mansion, I believe, was called Breeze Knoll.
Mm.
Whereas John would have made a more conservative purchase, perhaps a home for like $20,000 to $30,000. They instead bought the $50,000 mansion.
Oh my god, $50,000.
I know. But at that time.
I know, but oh my god.
I know. But at that time.
I know, but oh my god. We're talking 1965.
This home was about double their budget, right? Because their budget was like 20, 25, 30. And they were like, nope, the $50,000 home.
Yeah. Which is wild to me because they don't. You don't. I can't think of anybody who needs 19 rooms, but they don't even have enough family members to fill half of those.
And they don't have friends.
No.
It's not like John's like, oh, the family reunion can be at this house. Look at all the space we have. He didn't want to talk to anybody.
No.
Like, what? So, apparently, John opted for another home. Helen was hell-bent on this one. And it was because she wanted a more elegant home. Or at least, again, that's how John tells it, is that it needed to be the best that there was. And this mansion, which sat up and back from the road with about some distance between them and the neighbors, had 19 bedrooms, 3 floors, and a ballroom.
Oh. Elegant.
A ballroom. Classical music would often echo through the room at John's direction because all he listened to was classical music.
That tracks.
Completely what I'd imagine. It had 10 fireplaces, stained glass, chandeliers, an intercom system in the 60s, and it was the most expensive house in the ritzy, upscale northern part of the town.
Wow.
And everybody knew that John List bought this house.
Yeah, I'm sure they did.
Not because he was parading it around, but like, who the hell just bought the 19-room mansion?
Right.
Definitely not me.
No.
With a home like theirs, they drew attention. They had an air of importance. But John wasn't social, hardly smiled, and if you saw him in the yard, he was likely mowing his lawn, but he did so in a full suit.
Yeah, that tracks.
A full suit. I imagine him like, I don't know, did they have like a push mower and like throw in the tire over his shoulder and keep going, but like not with a smile. Not like, oh, how you doing, neighbor?
I don't think he'd throw the tie over. I think that's tucked in.
He was odd. Like when he moved in, a neighbor came by with a housewarming gift to welcome them to the neighborhood. It was like a cake or a pie or something.
Yeah.
And John basically said, thanks, but no thanks. We don't socialize with neighbors.
Oh.
Like, what an impression. But he had no interest in that. Like, he went to church, he went to work, he went home, he went to church, he went to work. Like, that was his life. And fraternizing with the neighbors did not cross his mind.
No, it didn't fit the bill.
No. And part of that could have been a little bit because he was embarrassed.
Right.
I do wonder if part of it was embarrassment, like him and his wife fighting and, you know, her being inebriated and not wanting to entertain neighbors. I wonder if a piece of it is that, but I think the majority of it is that just John didn't care about neighbors or others or any of that. That's just not the kind of man he was, which is fine. You don't have to, but it shows.
Right.
And it showed. And John was just, he was weird. Like, just beneath the surface, it was like he was about to explode, but you never really knew it.
I imagine he has a vein that popped a lot in his forehead region.
That, like, had to throb or something? Yeah. I don't know. But within the walls of the home, the family was not as picture-perfect, posh, and poised as John would want everyone to think.
Yeah.
Helen entered late-stage syphilis.
Oh, no.
Her overall health significantly declined. Physically, her muscles began to deteriorate, and she was bedbound much of the time. She was starting to go blind, and she already didn't have great eyesight. She'd experienced some kind of permanent injury to one of her eyes in her early 20s.
Oh, wow.
Then her condition only got worse.
Yeah.
And, like, the syphilis exacerbated the existing problem that she already had. Okay. And it already does cause problem with eyes. So
yeah, you got a real double whammy there.
Her brain had begun deteriorating as well, and by no fault of her own, she became somebody else.
Okay.
She emasculated him in front of their children, spoke of their sex life out loud, which, to John?
Oof. Horrifying for him.
Like, if he had pearls to clutch, he'd be clutching them.
Surely.
She grew resentful of his quirkiness and rigidity. She poked fun and made digs. She called him at work, demanding that he come home and change the baby's diaper because she refused to do it.
Oh.
He'd have to excuse himself at work, which humiliated him because it was like, hey, John, your old lady's telling you how to live, huh? Like, he was getting shit at work.
Right, of course.
But he just stuffed it down.
Yeah.
She's at home drinking, and he had to go home and take care of the kids, like, take a lunch break, run back to work, catch up on everything that he missed. At work events, when other wives socialized and were appropriate, Helen spoke out and drank and embarrassed him.
Okay.
Neighbors noticed that she'd leave lights on at all hours of the night. Like, she'd be seen cleaning through the windows in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
Like, 1 a.m., she's just up, like, vacuuming, and they're like, what is this lady doing?
I mean, it's a 19-bedroom house. It's a bitch to clean.
Well,
takes all day.
I'm sure there were rooms they never went in. I mean, but it's just that kind of thing where...
Yeah, it's odd.
Like, they were the odd family. They didn't socialize. They didn't come out. And then, like, you never really saw either one. You'd see John always dressed proper, but Helen's, like, washing windows at 3 a.m. It's just kind of weird. Her spending had not been reeled in. Not one bit. She needed clothes and accessories and other lavish items to match the mansion they lived in, because how could you not dress to the nines when you lived to the nines?
Right.
Continuing to spend money she didn't know they didn't have.
Okay.
It got to a point where John was sleeping in a different room.
Well, I got a bunch. That's good.
As I said before, I do wonder if part of this badgering of him was just trying to push him and keep pushing to get a reaction, because he didn't react most of the time, but usually he just took it and carried on. But I wonder if this is part of her deeper reasoning, like the parts of her, especially before it had really sort of ravaged her brain, if she was to know. And I mean, she entered late stage, but... as you know, this isn't what killed her, and she wasn't, like, completely bedbound, like...
She wasn't gone.
She wasn't on her deathbed, but she was not behaving the way that she did before. And a lot of it would be attributed to drinking, drug use, and the disease.
Right.
Impacting all of her body and her mental health.
Well, and then I think about his childhood, and not that there have been really reports of his dad being verbally abusive, but would there be in the 1920s? I'm not sure. Even if anybody knew about them, which it doesn't sound like they socialized enough for anybody else to really mm-hmm. notice, probably.
Nobody wanted to get close enough to them.
But my guess is he probably took a lot on the chin back then, too. And yep. his reaction was what he was taught to do, which is blend in and stay quiet and be dependable. And he's repeating this here. And she's probably losing her mind. Like, why don't you give a fuck?
Mm-hmm.
My words, not hers, I'm sure. But it just doesn't seem super compatible.
No, it's not. And I'm not calling Helen an angel by any means, but he also just, he wasn't mean.
Right.
But he didn't communicate. And that's what a successful relationship is effective, kind communication. If you can't have that,
yeah,
neither of you are happy. You yeah. know, neither of you are happy. And in this case, neither of them were happy with the other.
Right.
And when I said in the beginning, think of the pendulum, like it swings, like things are far. A lot of his ideas are out there.
Right.
And then we talk about his kids. And they're growing up in the 70s.
Mm.
And it is free love, baby.
I'm sure Elvis pissed him off. Whew, I know that was 60s, but...
He was so mad about those hips.
I'm sure he was. That's like, abhorrent.
Mine do not work that way. How? So let's take his daughter, Patricia, the oldest. Was a huge disappointment in his eyes.
Oh.
She was a teenager in the late 60s, early 70s, and hippie culture was on the rise. He thought her tight jeans made her look like a whore, and her friends were dirty hippies with no morals. We have the pendulum. His daughter's really leaning into this, like, 70s free love movement. He's really leaning into, I hate everything about this. He's not equipped to handle change.
Yeah.
His daughter was sinning, and nothing he did helped to prevent it. He tried to instill the values in her that he was raised with, the ones that he still lived by today. And she was into witchy shit.
Yeah.
But she actually was, like, into witchy shit. Yeah,
she liked Stevie Nicks.
Which, to him, for her to be a witch, like, actual Wiccan stuff that she started to look into.
Yes.
Baffling. Infuriating.
Okay.
Not that he'd say much. But she also... had opinions of her own, you know. Part of the movement, right, was like armpit hair and, you know, hippie music and
Woodstock and
Burks and, you know, smoking weed and not wearing a bra. I don't know, that's like describing a photo of the 70s. Some people loved that.
Yeah.
I think she was young and she wanted to, like, that's what her friends were doing. She was part of that. But then there's the part of just the normal social change that isn't to do with that, but is to do with the changing of the time, which was having her own opinions, considering her own education. What did she want to do? She didn't have to be at home and be a mother.
Generally wearing pants.
Like, what was, you know, some of that was just the times and some of it was the movement.
Yeah.
And for her, she dove into the movement and he was the other side of the pendulum, which was very against it. Whereas, like, in the middle of, like, having your opinions and shit and don't bother anybody was, like, where a lot of people fell.
Mm-hmm.
Him and his kids, different ends. So, not great, because we're going to get into a little bit more.
Okay.
In his mind, because her opinions and the way that she lived her life differed so much from his, she was sinning.
Okay.
But the worst thing of all that she could do, that she did do, that she wanted to do, was she wanted to pursue a career in theater.
A theater kid?
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm kidding. Sorry.
Being an actress, which in his mind may as well have been giving herself to the devil on a slutty platter.
Oh.
He viewed entertainment and the arts and things. I mean, remember, this is a man who classical music, ride or die.
Right.
So any other kind of, like, I don't know, like, I don't think he liked ABBA. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's just, like, anything that opposed that, he was so against, where she was really leaning into, like, the arts, and, like, she wanted to go for acting, and she wanted to, you know, she was in the theater group in high school, and most of her friends were theater kids, and they dressed up, and they did fun things like that, and, like, wearing a costume and dressing as, you know, that was demonic. Like, that was not okay with him. So,
right. Oh, they did not celebrate Halloween in that house. I know it.
His dad, actually, there's a really funny story. His dad hated Halloween. He was, like, known as, like, the Halloween asshole hater around Halloween. John's dad was.
Yes.
Then there's John, and he didn't like Halloween either. And then here she does. Oh, she just any day of the week, she'll dress up like something else. And, you know.
Oh, it skipped two generations.
The last straw with his relationship with Patty came in the summer of 1971.
Okay.
He was called at 2 a.m. to pick up his daughter from the police station.
Oh.
She had been brought in with a friend of hers. Now, they got picked up because it was after curfew. It was very late. Two young girls. They were walking the main drag, smoking cigarettes, which they shouldn't have been, laughing and being, like, a little bit loud.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they were drunk or anything. I don't think so. But they were just, like, being kids. I think neighbors called it in, or, like, a cop happened upon them and was like, what are you doing out here? Like, where are your parents?
Come
it's
on.
Late.
Yeah.
Like, you should be home. You have school tomorrow. And so they called the parents, and it was like, come get them. And I believe the friend's parent arrived and was, like, more annoyed that he had to get up to get her.
Right.
But wasn't all that angry about, like, did you sneak out or anything? It was kind of like, get in the car, we're going home.
Right.
But John shows up. And it wasn't that he was, like, his behavior that shocked the police. It was the fact that upon being woken up at 2:30 in the morning, he showed up in a full suit, as he did to every other event.
Oh my gosh.
In his life.
John.
And she's just like, yeah, that's my dad.
Could you imagine the look on her face, though, if he didn't?
I know. Like, what's wrong with dad?
Yeah. I think I would shit a brick if I was her and my dad, who was always in a suit, showed up not in a suit to pick me up at 2 a.m. I'd be like, oh, I'm in for it.
Yep. But instead, he smelled of aftershave because he got up, shaved, showered, put on a suit, put on a tie, put his shoes on, and headed out the door to just pick up his daughter from the police station at almost 3 a.m.
Oh, John.
That is odd. It's odd. It's not criminal, it's not creepy, but it is odd.
And it's peculiar.
You'd note it.
Yeah.
Right? You'd be like, I didn't, you know, the other guy came in sweatpants. I thought that's what you'd do, but all right. So anyway, not good. This was John's way. Patricia's friends recall her being scared of her dad and thinking that he hated her.
Mm.
That night, he scolded her and he called her a slut.
Oh my. And for him? That's a big reaction.
He said that she was going to go to hell and there was nothing he could do about it.
Oh.
Like, he was of the mind of, like, you're messing up so bad, there's no saving you.
There is, like, a whole second testament about how that works, but yeah, okay.
But if you consider his childhood.
I know.
Where, no, but seriously, a step out of line was, I mean, you're
hell worthy.
Like, you're getting, like, Amazon primed to hell 2-day shipping.
Yeah.
To see what his kids are doing compared to what he did and was allowed to do.
Yes.
Culturally and all of these things, like, how different is this for him?
Certainly.
Pretty out there. The last straw for John was when he was let go from his job at First National Bank.
Oh, no.
His position demanded that he have social etiquette. He had to make sales to foster ongoing professional relationships. And instead, he just put people off because he's John List.
Yeah.
And socially, he didn't cut it. And you did need to have a little bit of finesse.
You do.
The irony, that the accountant with the master's degree couldn't afford his home or have the conversations with his wife about run like their finances and making sure that they could afford to live.
Right.
And then was the vice president of a bank and then gets let go from that job.
Yeah.
Like, it's stacking up.
Sure.
They were already behind on their mortgage. Helen still spent money they didn't have. And now they'd go bankrupt because he had no income.
Right.
He took out a second mortgage. He dipped into his mother's money, which he did have access to because she was elderly at this time. She's like in her 80s. She's living there.
Okay.
But it wasn't enough. It still wasn't enough. And it wouldn't be. He never told his wife that he lost his job. Helen did still think he worked at that bank. But instead, he just got up every day, got ready for work as if he was going, left. And he'd spend the day at the train station.
Oh.
Watching the world as he'd known it slip away and analyzing over and over again how financially they couldn't bounce back.
Cool, cool. So we're not applying to jobs.
Oh, I think he was looking. He oh, was okay. trying, but he just didn't rub people the right way.
Yeah.
Of course, they could have sold the house. I'm sure you're wondering, Allie, why didn't they sell the house? I wondered that too.
Yeah, Allie, why didn't they?
I am with you, dear listener. They could have lived within their means, and God forbid they could have accepted help briefly if needed. But this would mean to John admitting that he couldn't provide for his family, which would mean admitting defeat, and he wasn't willing to do that because that would be a sin worse than murder, apparently.
Seemingly.
Weeks before the murder, John sat his children down and had probably one of the most haunting conversations that a dad could have with his kids ever, that if my dad ever had when I was a kid, I would have like run away.
Oh.
He asked them very coldly what they would like done with them after they died.
All right.
Essentially saying, like, it's coming, so what is it that you would like done with your remains?
Cool, cool.
Would you
cool,
like
cool.
to be buried or would you like to be cremated? They all said buried.
Okay.
Like, he sat down to have this conversation with them and then he left. That was it.
All right, kids, have a good Monday.
Like, the end is near. What are your final wishes? You know, you 13-year-old, I'm sure you've thought a lot about this. What would you like with your body after you're dead?
What do you tell your fucking friends at school? Yeah, I don't know, man. I just had a weird conversation
they
with
did.
My dad.
They did say that. They yeah. were like, how wild is that? That's crazy. And they were like, yeah, that's crazy. But yeah. They just thought their dad was weird.
Huh.
I mean, the friends thought their dad was weird. The kids, especially Patty, she was getting she was afraid.
I'm sure.
I can't imagine the man that you've never felt a strong connection with, who doesn't show love, who plainly doesn't like you, asking what you want when you die.
Especially as your parent. Most parents, if they're going to have a conversation similar to that,
they tell you what they want.
Yeah, because that's generally speaking sort of the way that timeline works, or at least most people hope it works. Not that anybody's hoping for that, but just in that natural flow of things.
Yeah, the natural order of things. And no parent wants to bury, I mean, you can't imagine.
Much less ask them what they want and then plan for it and then be like, okay, so I'm taking notes because I'll be here when you won't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Meanwhile, John did find other work, but this job made a fraction of what he was making before. I believe it was something like $5,000 a year. And if you'll remember, the home he owns is $50,000.
Yeah.
This didn't make as much as a dent in their expenses.
Surely.
John struggled with the way that his family was changing, as well as how society was changing. For a rigid, strict man who wanted order and obedience, as he was raised and as was demanded of him, he struggled immensely with what the 70s peace and love, free love, smoke your weed movement meant for their community, their family, himself.
Mm-hmm.
His wife undermined him in front of their children. His children disobeyed light years beyond what he would have ever done. His mother was breathing down his neck about how poor of a decision he made in marrying the woman he married.
Mm.
Can you feel the buildup? Do you feel the stress? I feel the stress for him.
Sure.
Now, Patty, his daughter, she had begun what I would call an inappropriate relationship with her drama teacher.
Oh.
I don't know the extent of it per se, but I do think that he might have spent time with her and her friends. This teacher, his name's Ed. Mm. I don't know that it was sexual, but like there was a fondness between them. And she confided in him and treated him like a friend. And
it's kind of odd. I see the vision. Okay.
She confided in him that she was afraid her dad would kill her. And he, I think he felt like, wow, this went further than I wanted it to. Like, you were this young, pretty thing that was giving me attention and I was giving you attention back. But now you're like telling me real shit. And I'm the drama teacher, and I think we need to stage for scene one, actually. Yeah. I got a blast.
What's that? Pit crew? Gotta go. CNPE.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like backstage, we're hearing too much noise. Okay? All right? I'm gonna treat you like professionals. You know? Like,
yeah.
That kind of stuff. So then when she brings this to him, he's like, oh, ew.
Okay.
And doing something about it also means admitting that there is something, whether right. whether she has got a crush on him or he's a little too interested in his student. I don't know what lines were crossed. It does seem like a line was crossed
somewhere, probably.
But she did go to a teacher that she trusted,
right?
An adult outside of the family that she felt she could tell.
She went to a trusted adult, which is what we always tell kids to do.
We do. And she confided in him. She thought her dad was going to kill her. And his reaction was not what many argue it should have been.
Okay.
You can look at it in 100 different ways. You can look at it from what we know now and be like, you should have done everything. You shouldn't. But I don't know what the right answer was. I just know he didn't do anything. And I don't think that was the right answer.
Okay. But so then he hears this and he swallows it, basically. He yep. says, okay.
And it was like, don't make anything actionable. Don't put me in a position like this. Like, I wish you just didn't say anything and, like, did nothing.
All right. Yeah, that doesn't sit well. Okay.
John then did something almost more unbelievable than the murders themselves.
Okay.
He let Patty have a Halloween party at their home.
What?
In October of 1971, he allowed Patty and her friends to celebrate a holiday he doesn't like with the kid he arguably dislikes the most. With the friend groups he thinks are all, you know, dirty sinners.
Yeah.
And he was like, enter. You can all come over and celebrate this demonic holiday. So that's cool.
Sure.
Holiday he hates, daughter who is now like covertly trying to become a witch and is into witchy spooky shit, my uh-huh. words, not hers, allowed all the friends who shared her views into his home. And that just sounds insane given what we know about John.
Yeah, the man turned down a fucking cake or a pie or whatever
because
mm-hmm. he didn't want to talk to someone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I'm kind of baffled by that one. It's almost like a last hurrah.
Well, there's a couple ways we can look at this. Either he's giving her an opportunity to further sin,
mm-hmm.
which would further justify his intention to kill her.
Okay.
Right? Look how far gone she really is. Look what she's doing. Look what she does when I let her do what she wants.
All right.
He was just going to let her prove how bad it really had gotten. Or did he think this was, like, philanthropic? Which, right. kind of to your point, a good deed before she goes. Like, let her have one last fun time. It's like taking a senior dog to run at the beach because you know they don't have long.
Yeah, giving them one last good day out.
Like, it's like make a wish for a dying child. Except this child doesn't know she's going to die.
Okay.
Maybe it's something else entirely. I don't know. But I think you could look at it both of those ways, and either one could be possible. As Patty and her drama club friends partied in the ballroom, John watched from upstairs, just fuming. He allowed them to come over so he could be angry about the things he knew they'd do when they came over. Like dress up, dance around, listen to music he did not approve of, use foul language, oh heavens.
It's just such a sinister picture. Like, I picture him over the banister on the railing.
He was upstairs, like, leaning over, watching them do all of the things he's so much against, just, like, stewing.
Yep, shaking his head, scratching his chin. What can I do to make them learn? Except he already clearly knows because he's already asking preparatory questions.
Correct. But then he sees one of the kids, I believe it was a boy, doing something that he disagreed with. It was either like kiss somebody or like drink, or I don't know what he did.
What, did he try to get someone knocked up before marriage? Sorry.
But whatever it was, it set John off and he like zipped down the stairs. Which, like, this does not strike me as a man who runs. And no. He booked it. So that's an image, I imagine, in a suit and tie. As if he'd been lying in wait to scold them. Like, he'd been waiting for one of them to do something that was, like, undeniably wrong that he could call them on.
Mm.
In this case, it was doing what many kids did then and still do today. Again, either kissing or drinking or doing something that, like,
right.
Is that all that odd and uncommon? No. But when he got to the floor, he tripped and he wiped out in front of them all.
Oh, no.
Embarrassing himself and further stoking his, like, his rage.
Oh, man.
They laughed.
Of course they did.
Which, you have his wife who is making digs at him. And talking about their sex life, I think being like, my ex was better, you know, like, not nice. He can't bring her to work parties because she's inappropriate. She didn't take care of the kids in their younger years, and now they're adults, and he had done his best, but she wasn't helping.
Mm-hmm.
The kids undermine him, too.
Yeah.
They're subscribing to ideas that he disagrees with, and he's frustrated he can't impact their mind further.
Yeah.
They are so deep in the hole financially.
Yeah.
That he knows they're going to lose the house and the shame that that will bring. He got a new job, which I don't even know if Helen knew that he got the new job. I think she still thinks he's going to the old job.
Right.
The old job that only barely let them not afford it. Now he has the job where he definitely can't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
Still spending as if they can't afford it. His mom just has this, like, displeased sort of view of everything. I don't know so much about the kids, but definitely his wife.
Yeah.
And then he wipes out in front of a group of teenagers, and they laugh at him.
I've had days where this would be enough for me to, like, crawl into a hole and not come out.
Yep.
Yeah. And I give him that. I empathize there.
I can feel the pressure. Not that I agree with him. Definitely don't agree with what he did. But, not, you know, like, I can understand, like, seeing people that you care about, you think are making decisions that are bad for them.
Mm-hmm.
And your wife spending money you don't have. Now, I think John was also spending money that they didn't have. But I think when he really didn't have it, he reeled that in, but Helen didn't know.
Right.
Where his wife's health is deteriorating and mentally she is unwell and going blind and is in pain. And
yeah, it's hard to watch. It's hard to be around. It's embarrassing because now she's saying things that he would never dream of. And
like, he would have never said out loud at all.
I feel for him, but also this is why I always say it's so important, like, that whole notion of you live, you learn, and you grow. In order to grow, you have to have those conversations and then do something about it. Otherwise, you're not really growing. You're just repeating.
Well, because he's not learning. Like, it's you live, right. You learn, you grow. He's just doing the living part. Like, he is just day to day. The learning comes in when you acknowledge that maybe how I'm doing things isn't working.
Right. And that would take not only communication skills, but it would take actionable steps and also knowing how you feel. And not that I think that he doesn't know how he feels. He clearly feels stressed out and overwhelmed and angry. But like, for someone who's bottling all of that up, it takes a lot to unpack to figure out how you're really doing at the root of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why bottling doesn't work, because it fucking ferments and then it makes a mess.
Yeah. So don't do it.
Don't
do it.
And as a clumsy girl, if I fell in front of teenagers and they laughed at me, I'd cry.
But I can see with everything else going on, this being like, bing, like the last straw.
Yeah.
Because he's, to me, he strikes me as the, like, goes down to the basement and, like, whisper yells.
Yeah.
Like, what am I about? You know, like, when you, like, when you were a kid and, like, you got yelled at and you went to your room and you're like, you're so mean, I hate it here. You know, and you, like, get all mad. And you're like, I just want to move out. You, like, want to pack a bag and leave. Like,
you replay everything in your head with what you could have said or what you should have said.
Yeah, you,
or
like,
whatever.
Say it to the door. You're like, yeah.
Yeah.
So take that. You know? Yes. He strikes me as that, where like, if he ever got it out, that is the extent he'd get it out.
Yeah.
And which is not enough.
No.
And that for me, that'd be a scream yell in the basement moment.
Yeah.
Afterwards. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is October of 1971, but we're going to skip ahead to December of 1971. Weeks had passed and the family hadn't been heard from.
Oh.
Neighbors noticed the lights in the mansion were always on, but one by one they burnt out.
Oh.
Eventually, law enforcement gained entry into the home and made a very gruesome discovery. And that, dear listener, our friends, is where we will pick back up in part
you
2.
You motherfucker. Okay.
I know.
I mean, I know what it is, but I'm already crawling about it.
That is where I must leave you. I will say nothing else on the matter.
Oh, my.
Mm.
Okay. And that's all I have to say about that.
That's all I have to say about that.
Oh, my gosh. All right. What an interesting, fascinating backdrop for one of the better known, like, familiar sides.
Yeah, he's an odd one, and as I said, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm going to keep going. What we'll talk about later is oftentimes in situations where a father murders his family,
mm-hmm.
usually at the end they take their own life.
Yeah, typically.
Like, it is to set your family free and the pain, whatever, like, narrative surrounds it. Mm-hmm. There are so many true crime cases that you will see this happen. The only other one that doesn't, that this strikes me like similar to, is Chris Watts, where he didn't. But normally in those situations, right? Like, Chris Watts had a girlfriend on the side.
Right.
He had other, you know, supposedly did he want to quote unquote get rid of that family to pursue a family with her? In John's case, he's not cheating.
Right.
He's not in love with anybody else. He's not leaving to be with anybody else. He's not interested in that. What we are gearing up to is like a man who snapped, but the snap happened over the course of like a couple of months.
Yeah.
But the buildup had been years.
So why do I get the ulcer?
Right? Yeah. How come you can only eat like unsalted rice cakes, huh?
Yeah.
I know it. Maybe he had one too.
Probably. He probably did.
And he wore a suit every day.
Yeah.
So
he didn't even have soft pants to get into.
He didn't have jam jams that he was living in.
And that's so fucked up.
Yeah.
I feel for him and the empathetic, like, I understand what a lot of stress is. I can feel this pressure, responsibilities a lot. There's a lot that's out of his control that he's trying to will into his control. But it also strikes me as very interesting. And again, I understand how he was brought up, the kind of rigid thinking that he was natured and nurtured into. But For a man who says, or for a man who did, read the Bible as avidly as he did, he is leaving out like an entire half.
Mm-hmm.
Like half of that.
I think a lot of people who use religion to do bad,
mm-hmm.
or in this case, what I think is cited religion, but this wasn't, it was not the reason right. for it. But I think they treat it like a buffet. Where they're like, I'll take a part of this part, and I'll take this. I'm going to leave that part. I don't want that one. I'm going to take this one. Yeah. That one contradicts me, so I'm going to leave that one here. I'm going to take this. Like, there's just so much cherry picking in what you're willing to acknowledge and other things, like, you won't pay mind to, where it's all important, so.
Right. Well, and also, like, I'm pro take what resonates, but if you're going to live your life so rigidly by sort of the written law of this, so to speak, to then just disregard half is kind of wild to me. And the half that truly is what made him a Christian versus a different sect of faith in general, which is really interesting to me. But I do think, so it's just fascinating. And I think it is such a good picture of his family. I can see this so vividly. It's like giving me a hint of BoJack Horseman mixed with that 70s show. Like, more uptight, more rigid than fucking Red Foreman.
Oh,
way
Red,
more
Red
reeled
Foreman,
in.
Red was so much cooler.
Yeah.
Red would, he'd have circle time.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
He hung out. He was strict but kind. This is not strict but kind. I love you. I want you to be able to depend on yourself, take care of yourself, take care of your family, but also have fun, enjoy life, be happy.
Right.
You know, those are the elements that I think make a good parent.
Yeah.
Versus he is just hands off, but hands on. Hands off emotionally, hands on with the physical requirements of parenting. Right. He will do those things.
You will physically be present.
But he has expectations for them without even really getting to know his kids.
Yeah, and it also sounds like if his communication was as poor with his kids as it was with his wife,
mm-hmm.
which, not saying that that's not possible, but typically if you're in a relationship, your communication with that person should be like the best out of anybody's.
I don't think he had good communication with anybody.
But that's what I mean. Yeah. Like, how do you even communicate to your kids your expectations and why you're afraid for them or concerned for their well-being or the motive out of this, which it did, frankly, in his own way, sound like love. Like, I want you to do well. I want to see you on a path to heaven on something that I care deeply about.
Mm-hmm.
But did he have the skills or the ability to do that? It doesn't sound like it.
Right. I don't think he ever sat with them and was like, these are the things that I believe in. And I want what's best for you in this life and whatever is afterwards.
Well, and it kind of reminds me in a kind of a roundabout way, but of the sort of stereotypical profile of a school shooter of like, I'm not going to stand up for myself. I'm not standing up for myself. I'll eat it. I'll eat it. I'll eat it until you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, it's like, get a grip, man. It's way easier to find that courage, be a little scared for 5 minutes, tell your wife that the spending needs to fucking stop, you need to sell the house and get a new spot to live,
mm-hmm.
than it is to deal with any of what he did or the aftermath and to live with that. It's also better for, like, literally everybody involved.
100% better for everybody involved. Yeah. To have the conversation, come up with a game plan together, or if it's divorce, I'd rather you commit that sin than the sin you did commit, which was the annihilation of 5 people.
Yeah.
So.
Spoiler.
For splitting hairs here, that's where I'd like to see it fall.
True.
But that's just my opinion.
How about you guys? What do you think? Do you want to send us a DM, an email?
Do you want to leave us a little note on Spotify if that's where you're listening? What do you think of this episode? What are your thoughts on John so far?
Yeah. Hit me up. Hit me up, you guys. Message us. Let us know. What are you thinking? This is part 1, again, Allie said, of 2 or 3.
Yeah,
so
TBD.
This should be a very interesting few weeks for us, but I'm excited. I'm buckled in with you guys. If you wanted to see the people, the places, the things that we talked about in today's episode or any other episode, you could do that over at our Instagram, which you'd find in our link tree below. I heavily recommend it. It's great. Allie runs it. She does a great job. I am terrible at that, and she has made it so much fun to be in, at, around. I don't know what the right preposition is for the Instagrams.
Thanks.
Yeah, you do a great job. It's fun. Oh. And if you guys need a reprieve, because this is terrible, and if you, like me, are getting stress hives thinking about the pressure from this man, there's a reprieve section. There's memes. There's silly, goofy little fun times. You could also send us and look at pictures of pod pets. We love them. We're obsessed with them. Do you want to dress your anxious and uptight dog like John List in a suit and send it to us? Because we'd fucking love it.
Oh.
His little suit with a tie.
His little suit.
Cute.
Give him little boots.
Yeah.
I love when they have little
A little
boot.
Bible.
Little boots.
If you want to do that, that would be great. You could also send us an email, which you could also find in our link tree. Check out any of the sources, which are down below in the description or in a linked Google Doc. It depends on how many characters we have left. And lastly, if you wanted to donate to the pod by either fiscally via PayPal or Venmo, or you could look at some merch on Redbubble, we'd love to see you do that too. But for now, if I do look at my clock, that was
about time for true crime.
Bye.
Bye.